everyone. Welcome back to the Queens of Social Work podcast. I'm your co-host, Queen P.
And I'm your co-host, Queen H.
We invite you all to join us this week as we share, laugh, cry, and learn through our experiences as women of color who happen to be social workers.
So here in the United States, the month of October is not only Domestic Violence Awareness Month, but is also National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Black women in the U.S. are 40% more likely to die from breast cancer than any other racial group.
According to the African American Breast Cancer Alliance, African American / Black women under the age of 40 can have more aggressive tumors and benefit from early detection and frequent breast cancer screenings, and medical treatment increases chances of survival. On the other end of the spectrum, elderly women may be less aware of breast cancer risks and delay seeking medical attention. This delay may result in more advanced disease.
The American Cancer Society says that African Americans have the highest death rate and shortest survival of any racial and ethnic group in the U.S. for most cancers. Since 1990, however, the overall cancer death rate has dropped faster in Blacks than whites among both men and women, largely driven by more rapid decline in Blacks for cancers of the lung, colorectum, and prostate.
We have a treat for you all today, as Queen Kay and Dr. Nicholson are here. Queen Kay is a native of Queens, New York, and has been working in the oncology field for over 8 years. With a background in clinical research and public health, she is passionate about cancer health disparities and health education. She currently works at an academic institution in New York City in community outreach and engagement. Dr. Stacia Nicholson is a scientist by birth and practice. She's a professionally trained toxicologist and researcher who received her bachelor's and master's degrees in toxicology from St. John's University, and she has her doctorate in pharmaceutical science from St. John's as well. She is the founder of AliquaTheScienceSpot.com, where she simplifies scientific topics for the everyday person. Welcome, Queen Kay and Dr. Nicholson. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yes, welcome, welcome.
So with that said, let's get started. Queen Kay, starting with you, what are your credentials? What setting do you work in? It was kind of said in your bio, but you can kind of give a little bit more description. And do you work directly with clients and patients? And after Queen Kay, then we'll have you go, Dr. Nicholson.
Sure. So just in terms of, I guess, credentials, I have a BA in sociology. So I started off there, and several years later, I actually went back to get my master's in public health with a specialization in epidemiology and biostatistics. So that's a little bit of my academic background and my credentials. In terms of where I work, so I work at an academic institution in New York City. I work in community outreach and engagement as a program manager. So in short, we are doing a lot of work in terms of screening and prevention of cancer within our office, particularly with a focus on health disparities and making sure we get out to the communities that are most disproportionately affected by cancer. So a lot of our work is based on the existing data. New York City has great data that's publicly available for people to just go on to the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene's website to see. And from there, you can get really nitty gritty into the data so you can see what neighborhoods are experiencing the burden of cancer is being experienced at a different rate than other neighborhoods. And, you know, that's tied to a lot of social factors that I'm sure we'll get into. So that's a little bit about what I do now. And it's a very rewarding career so far. I really enjoy it. And I say that this is the first time I've actually used the word career to describe what I do. So that's really nice. Because before, a lot of the work that I was doing was a job. But, you know, you got to do some jobs. You got to work a club to get here, right? So it's all good. You know, I took a search to his path and I'm blessed to be where I'm at. And then in terms of whether I work with patients or clients, I do not work directly. I guess a little indirectly with patients or clients. We work a lot with community members. So a lot of like education, making sure that they're kind of being the vessel of health education to the community and the people that they serve. Because, you know, a lot of times there's a lot of, and I'm sure, again, we'll get into this as well, a lot of mistrust within the medical community. And even though we may look like the people that we're trying to serve, if you don't talk like them, if you don't have a similar background, it may not be well received. So we like to connect with people who are already in the community, already have those ties, and educate them to be able to be what we call lay health educators.
Wonderful, wonderful. And Dr. Nicholson?
Okay, so as we discussed a little bit with my bio, my undergraduate degree is in pre-med toxicology, my master's is in toxicology, and my PhD is in pharmaceutical science with a concentration in toxicology. So I am well-versed in all things toxicology. So just to be clear, I know a lot of times when people think about toxicology, they think about forensics, or they think about when they watch these law shows and you hear about the toxicology report. That is not the type of toxicology that I am engaged in. I always like to stress that the field of toxicology is quite broad, and actually a lot of us work in the field of public health or with other clinicians, MDs, generally researchers, scientists, as well as regulatory, so institutions like the FDA or the EPA or even OSHA is usually where most of my peers have actually found themselves employed. So with that, I'm currently working as a postdoctoral research fellow. I'm actually in training, and my fellowship is actually in precision medicine. So what that really entails is looking at ways of identifying biomarkers that can be used to develop more person-centered, tailored therapeutic treatments. So, which I think is relevant to this discussion that we're having, and then relevant to the disparities that we see amongst African-Americans in this community, in this society that we live in. A big part of that is focusing on some of the genetic differences that may actually exist, that may contribute to some of the disparities that we see. I don't work directly with patients, but I do work with clinicians, being that I am situated in an academic research institution that is coupled to a medical center. So I do work with cohorts and so forth, and other researchers and public health communicators and so forth that have direct access to patient and patient samples. I generally work more directly with samples, being that, you know, I do research. More of biochemical sort, bench work, essentially, versus at like medical work. I think that pretty much clarifies the type of work I do. I don't work directly in cancer research. I have worked in the past in a pharmaceutical company that specialized in cancer and diabetes research, and I worked in drug discovery. That was between my master's and my PhD years. And so since then, I've progressed, and I'm currently working actually in Alzheimer's disease research, but my main focus is disparities in African-American populations compared to the society at large.
So my next question is, Queen Kay, what is your role in working with cancer?
A lot of my current role is more around, and I think I said this before, so forgive me if I'm repeating myself, but around a lot of screening and prevention. So what we do is we put together programs to inform community members about ways in which they can get screened, to educate them on when they should start screening. So we've done a lot of webinars within the last year, especially in COVID. So that's one aspect of my position. Another aspect is making sure that we're connecting people with screening services. So we get out to the community. We offer stool-based tests for colon cancer screening. We also assess eligibility to see if people are eligible for lung cancer screening. We may, even more recently, there are some mobile vans that are in New York City to do mammographies. And so making sure that we are working with community-based organizations to get their members, and we often work with faith-based organizations, so to get their congregation involved and to make sure that they're aware of screening. You know, one of the ways in which we hope to reduce mortality or the chance of someone dying from cancer is by, you know, the early detection of cancer. And there are a lot of screening exams that are available for the major cancers, so like prostate, breast, cervical, lung. And so we really want to make sure that we're connecting people to those services, because some people just aren't aware. They don't know when to start screening. Some people may have insurance issues, so they don't know that they could get connected to an institution like a hospital or an outpatient facility, and that there's charity care available at some hospitals. So that's sort of what we want to make sure, is that we are spreading the word as an office, and making sure that we're connecting community members with services that they need so that they can detect cancer earlier. And hopefully, you know, we don't see disparities, or we start to decrease the disparities that we see when it comes to death rates in cancer.
Okay, thank you for that. All right. And Dr. Nicholson, can you tell us a little bit more about your work with cancer in the past, in your scope?
It was just drug discovery. It was actually lung cancer.
So tell us more about what that is. What does drug discovery look like?
Drug discovery actually looks like a lot of multi-well plates and a lot of colorful compounds, a lot of robotics. This really doesn't look all that fun, actually, when you think about it. I was in high throughput screening. So pretty much what I did was I screened large libraries of compounds and looked for what they called hits, which what we specialized in was hits to leads. So leads would be the compounds that showed response towards whatever pathway it was that we were looking to either inhibit or to trigger, stimulate, depending on what the outcome was. And then from there, the other departments would take over and then do some of the toxicological work and some of the phase one and two testings to determine if those hits were indeed candidates for drug development. So we did the preliminary portions of that in pretty much using bioassays to identify, right, compounds that did target the pathways that were involved in whatever the cancer biology, in order to determine if this was a viable compound that could be made into a drug. So with that, speaking from the toxicological point, because, you know, people wonder, you know, how come we don't see drugs coming out as frequently as maybe people might hope? And that's because, you know, things may in vitro, being that within, say, like a non-living unit. So I did a lot of cell culturing, actually, cancer cell lines and things like that, that were also used in the targeting for some of this drug discovery. So once that happens, there's a few different types of toxicology bioassays that we would routinely run, and then just to see if they had direct toxicity towards, say, a lot of liver enzymes, because your liver is pretty much what detoxifies compounds and metabolizes compounds in the body. So any drug that's going into your body, depending on how it's interacting with your liver enzymes, is going to determine its reactions in the body. So those were the first tests that were done. And then from there, they move into animal testing and different things like that. And a lot of times at those points would be when they start to see, even some of the translational research that would start looking into different, you know, components of the biology, they would start to see different toxicology outcomes that would start showing up that didn't necessarily show up in vitro. So a lot of times, you know, we might identify a lot of compounds that may be potential leads, and ultimately zero or one might come out of that. So, and mind you, we screen thousands of compounds every week. So just to give a perspective on that.
That sounds difficult. I'm going to tell you. So it sounds very difficult, because if you're doing all this test and you might get one, I'm not doing no more tests. I'm not doing it anymore. I'm done. I quit.
Well, it wasn't so bad. I mean, we had the help of some robotic machinery to help with some of this screening. So thousands of compounds could be screened in a matter of days. It's just that, you know, there's different chemistries. For instance, so like sometimes a compound might make it through screening and look productive, and then it would say go to chemistry. And chemistry, you would try to modulate that compound to make it more bioactive or more bioavailable. So they might just modify the chemical, the compound a little bit, where it maintains its general parent structure, but maybe certain modifications will be made that will increase its ability to be absorbed, or decrease its toxicity, or augment its excretion rate and different things like that to make it more viable as a true drug compound.
Wow. And so this is really good to have both of you on, because you guys do very different things, but actually what you do affects, I don't want to say in the same way, but it addresses it, you know, in the same way. So meaning the education, the research, you know, the focus on public health, but especially, you know, for the both of you, you know, focusing on the Black population, right? That's the biggest key there, because even back in the early 90s, you know, we read stats on the 90s, but in the 90s, a lot of this stuff wasn't there. You know, they were trying to make it. So a lot of people died. And I don't want to say for no reason, but a lot of people died, you know, unfortunately. And, you know, my mother being one of those people, you know, from breast cancer, you know, and I think had she gotten it later in life, maybe she would have survived, because, you know, there's more research, there's more medicine, there's more education, there's so much more going on. But unfortunately, she developed it at 40 and it was aggressive.
Yeah. So I think that's a big part that you touched on, a lot of key words that are very important and relevant to what's going on now in terms of cancer treatment and in terms of the disparities. One of the things that you're mentioning being education. Because although the actual treatments for cancer haven't really changed that much, chemotherapy, radiation, they're still pretty much, you know, standard of care. But as you said, you know, we mentioned earlier in the introduction that the type of cancer that African-American women are tending to get is the triple negative breast cancer that is not responsive to some of the targeted therapeutics that they have out there. So whereas you have others, cancer types such as those that are hormonal in nature, those cancers will express either progesterone receptors, estrogen receptors, or what's the HER2 receptor. And those are the ones that they can target with some medicinal treatments that are targeted to those specific types of cancer. But with the triple negative, you know, you can't use any of those. And there, to date, there really isn't any targeted therapeutics for that particular type of cancer. So also, like you mentioned, it presents at a younger age. But oftentimes when people with that type of cancer do present, it's usually at a younger age. So usually they'll start seeing a lot of the other types of cancers around 55, 65. These triple negative breast cancers are occurring, right, like before 40, at 40, at a lot younger age, and they're far more aggressive. And so they tend to also be diagnosed at a later stage. So the problem with that is the normal screening is set to begin when you're 40. So if you have these cancers that are actually presenting earlier than that, by the time you even start screening, you may have already been developing this cancer. So now if it even is discovered at that age, it's already further progressed. And so the treatment really when cancer that has evolved in terms of education is that the earlier we can catch it is the better your outcomes are, the better your prognosis for survival, for having disease-free remission, or, you know, just even having to a later state of reoccurrence. So those things really are important. And as well as just even personal education, because a lot of people, you know, because, you know, when we talk about the disparities a lot of time and just going through the scientific literature that there was trying to really identify, you know, is there something that we can really pinpoint as the cause for these disparities? You know, like a lot of people point at maybe it's something racially involved, where perhaps treatment's just not being given fairly or evenly across the board. But what I actually was surprised to find is that a lot of studies really weren't finding, you know, a lot of evidence of any great difference in the guidelines that were being, you know, presented to patients and things like that. But what I was seeing coming up a lot, it had to do with behavioral factors that may be going on in the community. And it had to also do with belief and education concerning breast cancer, where people kind of, you know, had different understandings of treatment, where they thought, you know, if I get cancer, there's no point, you know, this is fatal, I'm just going to die. So what's the point in me going through treatment? Or some people feeling that the treatment was actually worse than the disease. And then it's even just not understanding the rate of progression, you know, so sometimes people may be diagnosed, but then they feel maybe intimidated, or because they don't know enough, you know, they hesitate on starting treatment. Or people may start treatment and for various reasons not maybe continue through with the treatment, or so they may have early cessation of, say, their chemotherapy, and things like that, which ultimately result in these poorer outcomes. So it's very important that we stress that and educate people so that they understand the realities about what breast cancer, what their risks are, because then there's also the belief in the community a lot of people have that, you know, breast cancer is a white woman's disease. And so a lot of people don't even think that they're at risk. And, you know, these type of things are causing African-American women to go in at later ages and not go into screening and not be proactive about their treatment sometimes in some cases. And so these things do lend an arm. And then especially, like you said, when, you know, you're dealing with a more aggressive form, we may not have time, the liberty to wait and, you know, seek homeopathic treatments or, you know, other type of things. You know, sometimes people might want to, you know, they're just afraid. And so they take longer to start treatment. And all these things, you know, affect the ultimate outcome.
And Queen Kay, in your research, because I know that you're saying that you study trends and, you know, you're educating the community in your research, you know, since we're talking about treatment and somewhat effects and maybe early testing, what have you found?
So a lot of what Dr. Nicholson spoke about, I've found as well, especially among communities of color. I think you have to kind of take it maybe twofold. So on their biases that occur from physicians. So, you know, you go into medical institutions and you would think that all doctors are here to, you know, be the best people. And unfortunately, they have their own perceptions of certain groups, and that gets into the way of treatment. And one of the things that Dr. Nicholson touched upon is clinical research, that when it comes to clinical research, that patients of color aren't invited to participate on trials. And not being offered a clinical trial means that you're not offered everything that, say, another person, whether they're white, whether they are more economically advantaged, whether they live in a certain neighborhood, that all goes into creating disparities because you're not getting the same suite in a sense of options that somebody else would. We also don't know the outcome of different drugs if we don't have diverse patient populations on the trials that we're studying. And so, you know, we have seen cases of where bias or the perceptions that physicians have kind of get in the way of giving the most robust treatment options. So that's one thing that does affect communities of color. However, on the other end, when it comes to just cancer and treatment, that there are a lot of misconceptions as well that people have because, you know, we saw with COVID, they're going to go on Facebook and look for information and talk to their friends and stuff. Go on the internet before asking people who do this for a living for the actual facts. So, you know, we see that with cancer where people have their own ideas of what it is because of what they've read, or maybe they saw a case of, you know, 20 years ago that they had a family member who went through this and they may have died only 4 months after their diagnosis. So they have the same sort of views if they were to get diagnosed with cancer. Well, I'm only going to last for 4 months. Like, what's the point of me starting treatment? Another thing that comes up, especially that I see for Black men and prostate cancer, is the worry or the concern, and understandably so, about your sexual health. And we see that with young people as well, about the concern when it comes to being a sexual being, and that there are certain body parts that are compromised through either chemotherapy, radiation, surgery. So we do see that. I recall, you know, women who don't want to have their breasts, and this is Black women. I worked in a public hospital setting, actually with Queen H. We were in a public hospital setting. We came across, we didn't even know we worked at the same hospital until one day we ran into each other. So I'm sure that she could also chime in. It's just that when you have a public health setting and people who just have different viewpoints, and because of whether it may be tied to them, this is their first entry into the American healthcare system, or whether this is just their first entry because they have been denied access because they don't have the right insurance to go to other places. So, they, you know, with that, they haven't developed the education in order to be able to make sometimes good decisions for themselves. So I say that to say that we have had women that don't want to get mastectomies because they're afraid that they'll be viewed as less desirable for their husbands or their partners. And those are real concerns. I don't want to discredit or invalidate anyone who feels that way, but there are ways in which there are wonderful researchers who think of that. There are doctors who think of that. And, you know, it kind of just goes back to the misconceptions that people just have about cancer and treatment and how they play out and across different groups, whether it's divided between whether you're born outside of the US or here, whether you're Black, white, a different racial background, whether you come from a different socioeconomic class, education level plays. So we see differences and disparities at every level in that sense.
And I think people have to understand too, like so many things have changed over the years. Because I remember when my mom had the mastectomy, you know, then they had this little insert that goes into the bra, like the silicone insert. But it wasn't the same color as her. It was just like, oh, it was different. And even the wigs back then may not have been good, but so many things have changed. Like some people, depending, and of course you have to ask your doctor, some people go ahead and get a breast implant. So yeah, they might've taken this up, but then you can go do this. Or there's so many different things they have. Maybe the inserts are better, the wigs are better. And so, like you said, both of you were talking about, it's just the education around it, but what can happen. And to know just because you have cancer doesn't mean you're going to die, right? And so I think that's the biggest thing, because people hear the big C and they're like, oh Lord, I'm going, I'm coming home. You know, they're like Sanford or something, grabbing their chest, you know what I mean? And not really understanding, like you have to understand what's happening first and get the knowledge of what you have, get your biopsy so that they can see what you have, and you know, and so, and then they'll tailor the treatment, and that will give you the proper education on what treatment to take. Are you just doing chemo? Are they just cutting it out? Are you doing chemo and radiation? Are you taking this pill that takes it away for 5 years? I forgot the name, and that one, you know what I mean? So there's so many different things, but the education is important, and this is why we wanted to have you guys on here, because we need to be educated, you know, as a Black community about this and how we can really not only just prevent, but when it happens, really how to navigate it. Because that's the thing, is really understanding the navigation part of how to navigate, where to go, how to get help, what to do, you know, who to talk to, what's going to happen, and understanding there's going to be both good and bad days. But that doesn't mean that you can't overcome it. And you have to go to the doctor, because, you know, I think sometimes religiously for some people, they'll feel like, well, God will heal me. Also, God gave you good common sense and gave you free will to make some choices. And the saying goes, God don't help people who don't help themselves. Okay. So part of that is you got to go to the doctor. You got to get the mammogram. Just because you go get the mammogram doesn't mean you're going to have cancer. So that's not going to cause you to have the cancer. You got to see if you got the cancer. You have to be in the shower and okay with touching up your breast assist. You understand? Laying flat on the bed. But no, but some people are not, especially you're talking about older generation and all of this, you know, sometimes you get uncomfortable. They think there's something sexual in nature with touching your breast. Listen, everybody got breasts. Touch up your titty now. Okay, touch them mm-hmm. up. Touch them up, you know? So, yeah. Right. So, thank you.
Yes. If I may, Queen H, just to 2 points that you made. So, when you talked about just even how treatment and cancer care has changed, I just want to shout out to all the patient advocates out there. It's women that look like us, that look like others, that have been advocating for these changes where wigs look better than they did some time ago. As Dr. Nicholson said, breast cancer was seen as a white woman's disease. So oftentimes those are the wigs that were made. They complemented the features of a white woman. And now we're seeing just better, I guess, options for Black women or even Black men, and more cultural sensitivity being incorporated into care. So I think, and a lot of that work has to do, thanks to patient advocates that are you know, making sure that the word gets out there. Just recently, Congresswoman, and I hope I'm saying her name correctly, Ayanna Pressley, who has alopecia, she's been advocating for Medicare to cover wigs. And it's a lot of that comes from her own experience. And she's in a position to be able to petition for that on behalf of people. And so, you know, that just kind of drives home the point of how important it is that there are patient advocates out there to bring awareness to these subjects and to advocate for change. And you also talk about navigation. And so that's something that I did not say that I'm involved in, but I help supervise patient navigators within our institution. And so that is a reality. People get a diagnosis of cancer and they don't know where to start. We know that cancer care is expensive. I'm behind, but I've been watching Breaking Bad. And we know that the reason why he started that is because he was diagnosed with lung cancer and was trying to help his family. And although his character arc has definitely changed since then, you know, that is a reality. People are in debt due to cancer. And so that's just one thing. How do you tell your family, you know, depending on your age, your mother was young. My father, actually, he had leukemia and passed away at the age of 39. So, you know, you can only imagine going through that period in life where you're hoping to have a full life ahead and you have young children and a spouse or a partner, whatever the case, and having to navigate those conversations. So it's, you know, it's just multi-layered, and that's where patient navigators can come in. They can't take all the burden off of you, but they can help you. There's patient navigators. It's a service. There are people who are dedicated. I'm so fortunate to work with people who are like almost put on this earth to do it. It's a little bit of social work. It's a little bit of counseling. It's a little bit of case management, but they are here to assist people in making sure that, you know, we're considering anything that would impede or present as a barrier to your care. So if you need help with transportation, they're there to help you set you up. There's wonderful financial assistance programs that even we're just getting trained on now, like drug companies, pharmaceutical companies that offer co-pay assistance. And so it's important that I think a lot more attention is being brought to the idea of patient navigation. And I hope it's something that we begin to see even more and it becomes part of like sort of the vernacular that we speak. We talk about screening. Well, if you find yourself in a situation where you are diagnosed with cancer, please know that there are people out there to help you.
Yeah, I think that's very good to know. And I think also like what you touched on about cost is another reason why it is so imperative that people get screened so that they can get diagnosed earlier, because the earlier you're diagnosed, it's the most cost-effective situation for you than if you're diagnosed at a later stage, tends to be associated with higher costs as well. So that's something that people should definitely think about and consider. And then another point that was touched on earlier in the conversation when you spoke about clinical trial involvement and you spoke about the aspect of clinicians not wanting to involve people of color. But I think we as a community also need to acknowledge that a lot of time people of color don't want to participate in clinical trials. And I don't even mean when you're sick. I'm even talking about when you're just healthy. A lot of times the people who show up for trials, they don't look like us. The lab that I'm currently working in, it's very multiracial, very diverse. And there's actually one postdoc that recently joined who's Hawaiian. And he was saying, we always get involved in these trials because, you know, the institution that we have, they're posted everywhere. I want to do this one. I want to do that one. You know, whichever interests the particular person. But he was like, you know, when he showed up, they're like, oh, wow, a Hawaiian guy. Like, we don't have anyone like you. And so being in precision medicine, these type of things point out to me because these are exactly the reasons why the therapies aren't there. The treatments aren't there because particularly there was one study that I was looking at, you know, when they were trying to, you know, investigate what really is at the root of these disparities. So they started looking at maybe there may be some genetic factors and the panels that they had of genes that were risk factors for cancer, breast cancer. You know, they found that, you know, when they looked at white populations, and, you know, the people, you know, they were matching up very well with these, with this profile. But when they looked at African-American women, they weren't really lining up with these profiles, though these people also had the same risk of cancer or presented the same type of cancer or whatever have you. Essentially, what they surmised was that it's because we don't have the full panel. The panel that we have is only representative of European ancestry. And there may be a whole slew of other genes that are associated with other ethnicities that we're missing because we don't either as clinicians and doctors pull from the full population. And then also for those who do want to maybe do some of these studies, it's a very difficult to recruit the populations that we're looking for because there's an aversion because, you know, people cite things like Tuskegee, rightfully so. But I think as a population, we need to, in a community, we need to move past some of these fears because ultimately now we're starting to do a disservice to ourselves because, you know, it's like the lottery. If you got to be in it to win it. Because, you know, even with COVID, like we were talking about, I've heard people say like, oh, I'm not taking the vaccine because it wasn't developed in people like me. How do I know it's going to work in me? And it's like, right. But if people like you don't show up for testing in these trials, they're not going to break their backs to go out of their way to make something specific for you. You know, so it's like we have to take some responsibility and be a little bit more proactive in demanding, being vocal for our health, for our needs, for our concerns, and showing up. So, you know, that takes many different faces, you know, so whether it's in participating in trials voluntarily, because these trials don't just look for sick people, they are looking for healthy people as well. So I think it's very important for people to start considering maybe participating in things like that. And again, you know, those things also avail you to, for one thing that we always joke about being postdocs, you know, postdocs aren't paid great. And so we always joke about how, you know, we're getting free healthcare here to some degree because, you know, co-pays still exist even when you're insured. And so it's like, if I, you know, even certain things, you know, they might say, oh, you're young for this, so we're not going to do this screen. Or you don't fit this category of risk, so we're not doing that screen. So if I see something that's offering an MRI and I may feel like I may benefit from an MRI, I guess for free. I could get a CAT scan for free, you know, all these different things. You know, so it's just like, it may be in your best interest to sign, and these things pay. A lot of them pay, and some of them pay very well. So it's something for people to think about. So I think that's one thing. And yeah, and definitely, because, you know, like I said, I mean, my website is geared at not only just explaining science issues in a layman's term, but also in dispelling a lot of misconceptions and misinformation that is out there. And so I feel like it's very important that we stop going on social media and just talking with a small circle of people about our healthcare and start getting into a broader circle of people from different socioeconomic backgrounds, from different education levels, and really exposing ourselves to different, you know, groups and ideas so that we can start to see what other people are doing. And so we can pull some of the beneficial information from outside and bring that in so that we can help ourselves, because people are out there availing themselves of the knowledge, or just maybe they're more, you know, these things are just better set up in those communities. But we have to start going out and getting that information and bringing it back and start promoting that stuff on our social media and stop spreading all these, you know, these crazy memes and these things that have no scientific background to them. This is beyond cancer. This is with everything I see, where I see people have a propensity to want to share these crazy memes. And when I question people, like, hey, why do you believe this? You know, they really can't tell you. And it seems that a lot of it is based on emotion. So I think we have to get to a point where we move past fear, we move past emotion, and we start getting to a point where we can make our decisions based on their actual facts and actual true information, and not some, oh, well, my girlfriend's brother told me. And so it's like this type of thing, I feel, is, you know, it needs to stop happening because we're doing ourselves a disservice.
I think that you said amazing things, Dr. Nicholson. And I guess for me, just on the opposite end of things, when it comes to community outreach and engagement, that's exactly like sort of why we do the work that we do, and to kind of put it in perspective for those who are listening. Because just for the simple fact that there is a lot of misinformation out there. And I think a lot of times, you know, we started off at the beginning saying that we're both from academic institutions. And basically what that means is that there's a lot of research being done at our institutions, and to put it in the simple terms, and a lot of money being funneled in from like grants and things that you wouldn't necessarily see at maybe a community-based center. And so I think that when we see these flyers, we may see them around our institutions, but are these same institutions reaching out to the communities and having them come to do these studies? Are they providing the education? Are they providing transportation? a lot of times, especially in New York City, academic institutions are pretty much in Manhattan. And so that's about it. I can't really think offhand of a research institution, with the exception of an institution in the Bronx, but most of them are in Manhattan. So if you live in, say, in Queens, in Jamaica, Queens, and you're telling me I got to get on the train and possibly the bus to get to this appointment for research, and you're not paying me, or you're not paying for transportation. And now people are doing a better job. You know, they recognize that we got to, you know, we have to incentivize people for these things. But a lot of times these institutions that were not going out into the communities or making it easier. And so I think that, you know, we have to be innovative in our ways as the healthcare community. And, you know, it's just easier to find somebody who believes in what you want to believe in. But if we had people who had such a strong social media presence from the academic side and sciences, and I'm happy that your website exists as a place where people can get this information in a more simplified way and speak to the community in a basic way. Because the minute as us as academics and stuff, we start talking, we go into these big words, it just, it, you know, people shut off. They're not listening anymore. So we definitely have to be mindful of that. So I think it's, you know, it's both ways. And I think COVID shed a lot of light onto this, that you want, all of a sudden you want people to believe scientists, but what have scientists been doing in the community? It's easier to believe a HOTEP who has a stronger social media presence than...
Well, you see, and that's my concern though, because it's like, why do these people have a bigger social media stretch or appeal or these type of things? And a lot of times this is because people, this has nothing to do necessarily even with people just have an aversion to anything education related a lot of times, because they feel like it might be over their head or it's just not entertaining. And so they tend to listen to who they know, who is popular. And so that for me is like one of the hardest things that I struggle against at, you know, doing science communication, where it's like, I'm always trying to figure out, you know, what is the best way to reach people? And what are the things people are trying to, you know, hear? What are they trying to find out? What are the misconceptions? Because I find a lot of it is rooted in that, the belief system. And so it's like, if we can understand why people feel the way they feel about these issues, it's a lot easier to communicate to them. But that's why I'm like, we need to move away from fear-based or feeling-based decision-making and get more into an education-based decision-making. And actually with a lot of these studies, most of them do pay for your transportation. Like there was one point when I had graduated from my master's degree program, and I was searching for a job, and you know, I needed to pay my bills. And my sister's sister actually sent me one of these research trial things from a research institution, and they were paying. It was, I remember it was really far. I was in Queens at the time. I had to take a couple of buses and trains, but they actually paid for the transportation. And that to me was like, ooh, because if I live nearer, I wouldn't get paid as much. So I was like, wait, I can literally get paid a couple of $100 just to go travel to and fro, let alone go through the diagnostic procedure. I actually was able to incur a good month's worth of pay for my rent, which wasn't that much at the time, obviously, but I think it was about $500 to $600 for 2 days of going back and forth and answering some questions. I was like, yeah, I will jump on this bus and train, because I didn't have any other source of income at the time. And fortunately, about 3 weeks later, I found a job. But yeah, no, it was really crazy. So they do a lot of a better job now at incentivizing people, but I've seen most of the ones I've seen, they do cover travel. And as far as you said, right, they really are mostly posted in the institution, which is kind of ridiculous. So I've actually taken it upon myself to try to share this on my Instagram. When I do see posts, I will share whether ones that I'm involved in, usually those ones, or, you know, even other ones I'll share in my stories or so forth for anyone. And I, you know, if anyone's interested, I always let them know. You can email me and I'll forward you more information, because I think it's important. I think it's very important to get involved in these things, because we have to be the change that we want to see. At the end of the day, you know, they're not fighting for us. We have to fight for us. So there are some people on the inside that are doing the work to bridge the gap. But we all have to do the work. We can't just rely on someone else somewhere at some point. And this is why I really try to stress science education with my site and breaking things down in hopes that people can better understand. Because honestly, most people haven't had any kind of medical or science education since high school. Because if you never went to college, or even if you did go to college and you didn't major in a science, what did you have? At best, maybe one biology class? You know, so that's what, 18, 19 years old we're talking about, when most people have had their last bit of scientific medical education. That's a big gap. So I'm not surprised, especially with all the advances we have medically and scientifically, that a lot of people are struggling to understand things. And, you know, what they do understand is based on old knowledge. Because, you know, like, look at the vaccine. People are thinking, how did they make this thing so quick? How come they couldn't make this and they couldn't make a drug, you know? And all these different things. And, you know, that to me, you know, it's clear to me, because that comes down to, like I explained earlier, with some of the drug development. Developing a drug and developing a vaccine are two different beasts, actually. So, you know, but, you know, people don't know that. They see everything as all the same. Because I did find it interesting. I was kind of figuring out, like, why is it that people seem more willing to take a drug than the vaccine? Because, like, everyone's like, oh, can't, you know, like, when they had the hydroxychloroquine, when it was even with the ivermectin, people were more willing to want to say, oh, yeah, give us that, versus taking the vaccine, which was just very interesting to me. And I haven't really gotten to the bottom of why that might be.
We'll never know. We'll never know. And that's a whole topic of a discussion, and probably we'll have that on another session, because that is a big thing. And it's a big situation, especially among Black people, because people are not trusting. There's this mistrust, but you know, I think we need to move forward, you know?
Yeah, because I kind of wonder, like, if there was, say, a vaccine that was to come out, because, you know, cancers are a heterogeneous disease. They're not all one thing. It's not one size fits all. They're not one disease. But imagine, like, say there was some vaccine that was able to come out that said, hey, this vaccine here will prevent all cancers. Would people take it, considering what we're seeing now in terms of people taking vaccines? Or would they say, well, no, I'm going to stick to the chemo? Just makes me wonder.
Yeah, I mean, I have my, I can go on this topic all night. I will not bore you with that. But I will say, I think we've all have been touched by cancer in some way, whether you know, have been directly affected or seen a loved one, et cetera. So I think that it's more of, for them to see the potential impact of a disease like cancer. And that's not to scare people, because we have come a long ways when it comes to survivorship. So I don't want to make it seem like it is a death sentence. It's not. People, especially with breast cancer, it's just been like wonderful to see how long people live with even disease that has spread outside of their breasts. So like once it metastasizes. But I think that if a vaccine were to come out, I think more people would be willing to take a vaccine for cancer.
So it's like, you know, with the whole idea with cancer and a vaccine, because, like, for instance, like we have the HPV vaccines, which prevent certain cancers, and people don't want to take that either. They're over there saying, you know, it's causing autism, it's causing autoimmune disease.
Or even some parents who are concerned that, oh, I give my child, you know, because the initiation of that vaccine is around 11, 12, mm-hmm. maybe a little bit younger. It's almost giving them freedom for them to start having sex. And right. We're like, no, I mean, we have something. Cervical cancer, especially the majority, if not up to upwards of 90% of cervical cancers are caused by HPV, that we know. And there are certain strains of HPV that will cause cervical cancer. And thankfully, we have a vaccine that prevents that virus from developing into a cancer. And so it's just baffling how people, what they choose to believe. You know, it goes back to our early discussion of that, what they choose to believe.
Right. So ladies, we're going to get down to our final question, and then we're going to go ahead and give some resources. So if you guys want to share your social media at this point, or if you guys have an organization you want to share at this point, we'll get to that. Okay. So the last question, what do communities of color need to understand about cancer? We've hit a lot of points. A lot of information has been provided throughout this dialogue, but we want to know, like, in parting, what are the critical for people of color, communities of color to know?
I would say what's critical is to get screened, to start treatment early, and to get educated. those are the critical things that I think are the takeaway from this, because these things will save you in cost, save you in disease progression and severity, and overall give you a better likelihood of surviving and surviving without reoccurrence of breast cancer. And also, I think it just would give people a lot more peace of mind and a lot more power in knowing that they have some control over the disease and over their treatment and over their body.
Yes, Dr. Nicholson. Yes, I agree wholeheartedly. Queen K?
Yes, I don't have much more to add to what Dr. Nicholson said. I think that she really hit the mark on what needs to be known. One of the things that we have on when we have our webinars, we always like to end with early detection saves lives. Make sure to be up to date on your screenings. And that is something that you can discuss with your healthcare provider. And if they're not having that discussion, ask them. You need to make sure that you are your own best advocate. So make sure that you are bringing that to the attention of whoever is your primary care physician. We hope that primary care physicians are sitting here and abiding by the rules, but some don't. You know, that's just the reality of the situation. And so make sure that you are advocating for your own health. I think health education is important. Make sure you verify your sources all the time. Make sure that you seek unbiased sources. Question everything. That's all I tell people, question everything. It's fine. A doctor says something, question that too. Make sure, but come to a conclusion that has been decided on based on facts. We need to stick to the facts. And, you know, there are ways and to tap into that. You know, I personally enjoy doing this type of work. Dr. Nicholson, the way she's speaking, I see that she enjoys doing this type of work. And we're just two of many of, you know, researchers, program managers, public health professionals that are really passionate about this work and will talk to people all day. I could talk to people all day about this stuff. So that's another thing. And I think lastly, you know, a lot of the emphasis has been on diversifying clinical trials. And so I think that when it comes, especially to cancer care, that we want to make sure that clinical research is not viewed as a last option, that it really is integrated into the treatment if someone were faced with a cancer diagnosis. So that's another thing, is just that you want to advocate for, you know, the access to clinical research and that you're informing yourself when you can on that topic. I think that a lot of times, you know, we don't know until the drug has been approved and then it goes into people that look like us. And that's where we start finding out that this drug doesn't work. So I think it's really important. And the more people that we have that participate on clinical research, we started off talking about triple negative breast cancer, that is, it doesn't express any specific receptor. So if you think of like this thing that it's like almost a puzzle piece, drugs have been created so it fits the other puzzle piece. And we don't have that for triple negative breast cancer. So a lot of research needs to be done in that area because it's a type of breast cancer that affects Black women at a higher rate than other racial ethnic groups. So I conclude with, make sure that you are thinking about clinical research. And even before a cancer diagnosis, we talked about that. Like, you know, if you're healthy, there's plenty of clinical research that's making sure to have healthy volunteers, and we need healthy volunteers. So get involved where you can.
Okay. So can you let us know one of the organizations that does this testing? Clinical trials. I mean, where can we sign up? Because we want the dollars, right?
We want the dollars. Yes, we want the dollars.
We want the dollars, and we want to be healthy. And
yes,
so that when we need treatment, we can get it. So that's the most important. That, you know, we've talked about disparities and access. We need access, and we can't get the treatment if we don't sign up, listeners. Okay, so go ahead.
Yes. So one of, if you want to take a look at where all trials have to be registered through the government. And so that's on clinicaltrials.gov. So clinicaltrials.gov. You can go on there, find all types of trials. So not even cancer trials, all types of trials. You can filter it by location. So that's one resource. Another resource is, if you're familiar with the healthcare system, that you could always look on their website in terms of getting more information. One of the things that we know is an area or an opportunity of change is making sure that we are educating community providers, but you could also ask your provider. You could ask a primary care physician or whoever is your care provider, whether it's you have to see a neurologist, if you are seeing someone for your kidneys, seeing someone for your diabetes, you could always ask them. So those are areas or resources that you can rely on. And I'll stop there so I can give Dr. Nicholson, I'm sure she knows some other places that people can look up trials as well.
I think the one you gave was perfect because being that, you know, it's centralized, I think it's much easier to trust than just randomly Googling because, you know, I think some people worry that, you know, is this trial that I'm even reading about set up by some, you know, reputable people. But with that, using that word, I would say, yeah, like the places like Memorial Sloan Kettering, Columbia University, a lot of these major research institutions conduct trials. So just even right going on those sites and searching on those sites, then, you know, people can find information. Or like I said, I post things when I see them. So yeah, maybe people should go follow some scientists and some clinicians on Instagram instead of just following the rappers and the movie stars. And yeah, really to start, you know, not being afraid of science and not being afraid of medicine. And because like, I feel the more that you educate yourself, it's the less likely that you're able to have these issues politicized. And I feel like a lot more scientists and, you know, doctors need to get involved maybe in politics as well to start influencing some of this information so that people don't feel like, well, we don't hear this one doctor from the NIH. Like, how come we're not hearing anybody else? Or the people that they're picking are cherry picked and they're all mouthpieces and puppets and this type of thing. I think if at the ground stage, you know, some of us really start to integrate ourselves and understand some of the our local community associations and legal entities and just really start lending our, you know, our mouths to those places, because the people in politics, they don't know either. And they're doing what they do. What they do is sensationalize. What they do is work their, you know, what's right for their, you know, whatever their, you know, I don't even use the word agenda because that sounds like something negative, but, you know, whatever it is that they're set up to do, they know how to gear people to respond. So it's like when you see an article and it's clickbait, the title that media has put on there is something that they know is going to get you to read the article. And this is another thing I always tell people, because a lot of times the actual title of the article and what's actually in it are two different things, but they title it a particular way to get you to click on it. And but sadly, what I think a lot of these people haven't realized is a lot of people don't like to read. And so they just read the headline and not the actual article. And that's actually what I've noticed is a source of a lot of misinformation that I get when I talk to people, because the people will send me stuff. They're like, oh, I read it online. Let me send you the link. And then when I actually open the thing and read it, I'm like, did you read this? Because if you read this, it actually says the opposite. And that's when I started realizing that people weren't really reading things, and clickbait things and sensationalized things were really what was informing a lot of people, because they were playing on people's emotions. So that's why, again, you know, I advocate make education-based, logic-based decisions. And when you have to make decisions, I would say to anyone listening, think, am I making this decision out of a feeling, out of a fear? Or am I making this out of something logical? Like, I know we don't want to be all encompassing here, but just to give a reference again to COVID, when I got vaccinated, that was something I had that I used to help make my decision, because we actually, the option for me came a lot earlier, and it was earlier than I expected it. And so a couple of us were kind of like, oh, are we going to go down? Are we going to get it? Are we going to wait? And, you know, people started talking amongst ourselves, and here we are, a group of, you know, researchers. And I realized that a lot of what I was hearing was seeping into my mind too. And I had to really step back and think about it logically and say, okay, what are my fears? What is driving me right now? And then once I was able to separate my fears from what was I knew to be true and what the real risk associations were, then I said, okay, I'm being crazy. I'm listening to this, that, and the third that I know is actually not true, or I know is actually not logical. So that's fear-based. What's fact-based? And then I ran that list and I said, okay, boom. And I made my decision to go ahead and get vaccinated. So I think a lot of times if we break things down like that, because what I just see in life in general, anytime I feel led by fear, I do the opposite. because fear mm-hmm. is false evidence appearing real. You know, it's an acronym. Mm-hmm. So that mm-hmm. would be my final takeaway.
We're gonna have to use that.
Yes.
We ain't got no fear in here. No false evidence, okay? Ain't appearing real up in here.
Okay.
Yes. So just to give some resources, we want to share with you some organizations that are doing some really good work in this field with people of color. Feel free to check out Dr. Hydea Green, who is doing valuable cancer research for women of color. Her cancer research foundation is Oralee, Oralee.org. She's also on Facebook and IG at Oralee.org.
Yes, in addition, if you or someone you know has cancer, there are good resources out there that they can reach out to. There's American Cancer Society, which we all know, Susan G. Komen. There's also Cancer Care that offers and provides limited financial assistance for home care, child care, transportation. Their number is 1-800-813-HOPE, H-O-P-E. And if you're using a new phone, those numbers would be 4673. So it's 1-800-813-4673.
And then we have Living Beyond Breast Cancer. They have grants and they can be used for living expenses such as mortgage, rent, utilities, and transportation. Grants will range from $500 to $1,000 depending on the applicant's circumstances and as funding allows, of course. Please note that grants cannot be used to cover medical expenses. And their contact number is 1-855-807-6386, 1-855-807-6386.
Okay. African American Breast Cancer Alliance is also out there. This is a nonprofit organization out of Minneapolis that offers education and survivor support groups. Sisters Network, Inc. is out of Texas and offers grief and bereavement groups as well. Their website and contact information will be in our show notes. So thank you to our guests, Queen Kay and Dr. Nicholson. You can find Dr. Nicholson on IG at Alicott the Science Spot, and I'll spell that A-L-I-Q-U-O-T-T-H-E-S-C-I-E-N-C-E-S. P-O-T, I know it's long, P-O-T. And of course, all of that will be in our show
notes. I usually just spell the aliquot part and then say the science part.
Okay. Got it. But we're going to have it in our show notes so you guys can go ahead and follow and, you know, stay in touch.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, so thank you, ladies. It's nice having you on. You two are wonderful Black women out here trying to save our people.
Yes.
And making sure we know what we need and we out here surviving and thriving. Okay. So thank you for coming on. Thank you for coming on. We greatly appreciate that. If you guys want to connect with us on social media, you can follow us on Twitter at the Queens of Social Work Pod or on Instagram at the Queens of Social Work. If you want more information on the topic we discussed today, feel free to check out our show notes or email us at thequeensofsocialwork@gmail.com. We'd really appreciate it if you rate, review, and follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening.